Good evening, friends, and welcome. Welcome on this weird evening when night came a little too soon. I noticed that the birds began to quiet and the crickets began to sing a little too early. Unexpected. But here we are in this kind of Mars-like sky. Welcome and thank you for being here. Let me just do a quick sound check. How's my volume? Or do we need to go up or down? We're good? Okay. Thank you. I've been looking lately at a couple of teachings from Dogen, and I thought I would share my process with you a little bit. I started with the Ehe Koso Hotsugamon, that is the teaching that we, during Sesshin, recite before the teaching is offered, before a Dharma talk. And it is known as Ehe Dogen's teaching on arousing the vow for practice. And it has in it, at the very end, this is the pure and simple color of true practice, of the true mind of faith, of the true body of faith. And I've been puzzling some, you know, how would we know if it's true? So then I explored a little bit more and came across another teaching by Dogen. You will recognize the name. It's called Bendo Wa. That is known to be about one of the first teachings that Dogen offered upon his return to Japan from China. And that translates as negotiating the way. The Do part is the way. Negotiating the way. In another translation, I'm sure you know that the characters in Sino-Japanese each has much more than one meaning. So sometimes it's hard to kind of pin it down. But Bendo Wa can also translate as how to pursue the truth. So I read that and pretty carefully, and you will recognize one small part of it, maybe a third of it actually, is something that we recite called Jiju Yuzonmai. And I'd like to read to you the part that we recite toward the beginning that says, when even for a moment you express the Buddha's seal in the three actions by sitting upright in samadhi, the whole phenomenal world becomes the Buddha's seal, and the entire sky turns into enlightenment. And I found another translation that revealed something to me, so I'll read that to you as well. This is out of the Heart of Dogen's Shobo Genzo, and this particular translation is by Waddell and Abe. Really quite beautiful in the way these complex things are languaged. So here it is in another form. When even for a short period of time you sit properly, imprinting the Buddha's seal in your three actions of deed, word, and thought, then each and everything throughout the Dharma world is the Buddha's seal. And all space, without exception, is enlightenment. So, of course, you recognize that deed, word, and thought, body, speech, and mind, you see that. So, I'll repeat it so you can track it. When even for a short period of time you sit properly, imprinting the Buddha's seal in your three activities of deed, word, and thought, then each and everything throughout the Dharma world is the Buddha's seal, and all space, without exception, is enlightenment. This revealed something to me about sitting properly and allowing the Buddha's way to penetrate or permeate is better even permeate body, speech, and mind. So soon after having some understanding about that, that may disappear at any moment, I recognize that every moment is one of those pivotal times when we can turn toward vow, the vow that we enact through body, speech, and mind. We recognize the habitual and a pivotal moment and turn. So I was quickly challenged. Last week, someone asked me a question that gave me pause. That was this person, a practitioner, asking about his friend, also a practitioner, how to support her in the best possible way. And the friend had proposed wanting to do harm, actually wished that a particular political leader would die. And so the person who posed this question to me, how shall I best support my friend? So I offered something in the moment, and that something was this, that it would open the heart of compassion to recognize that even that individual for whom some might have distaste has a set of conditions. And, for example, if I had exactly that same set of conditions, I would actually be that person because I'd have exactly the same conditions. And so I would actually be doing that very same thing. So the set of conditions and recognizing it as nothing other than that helps to open up the heart of compassion. But I realized soon after that conversation that there was a lack of depth in my response. So I returned and apologized for my lack of vigor and my lack of thoroughness, and addressed it in a slightly different way. That, yes, it's true that that person on whom we might wish harm has a set of conditions, definitely, but that set of conditions exists within a larger set of conditions. And this is what, in contemporary speaking, we would call systemic. It's systemic. So rather than wishing harm to another, we could figure out a way to make a choice that's consistent with our values and address the conditions of the conditions, or begin to see through the superficial conditions and see something that's a little deeper. So the intention of the friend who wished harm was to stop the pain, to stop a distasteful condition. So a first step might be to acknowledge that it's exactly correct to want to stop the pain, to stop suffering. And then it's a possible next step to support a friend to engage their wiser self, or the equanimous self, the self who knows how to sit properly and engage body, speech, and mind. And maybe a little bit more effective than wishing harm or doing harm, to work at the root of the conditions of the conditions. And in this case, doing something to work, for example, to get out the vote or to assure that people are registered to vote. So this task of allowing ourselves to go deeper into the conditions of the conditions, to recognize the system part of it. Now there's another part. That is, we have to find our own place. So, I myself need, and I imagine you might need sometimes, help finding my wiser self. Because I have a pretty reactive self, maybe even a competitive self. So in our practice, we have several reference points. For example, the paramitas, these are called the perfections. And perfection is a tricky word in English because it seems to set an ideal that is pure. But the perfections in our practice are known as a place where we exert effort in generosity, in ethics, in patience, and make effort, not just simple effort, but joyous effort and concentration, ideally resulting in some wisdom. So those are big concepts, and there's not a lot of verbs there. So I look for verbs. What exactly is the action, you know? If we need another reference point, then, for finding our wiser selves, we can turn to the three pure precepts. I vow to embrace and sustain right conduct. I vow to embrace and sustain all good. I vow to embrace and sustain all beings. Now I'm getting a little closer. There is an actual verb there, embrace and sustain, and it gives me kind of a realm in which to operate. And yet, these are still kind of vague. Therefore, the Buddha in his wisdom gave us the 10 grave precepts. A disciple of Buddha does not take life, does not take what is not given. And so on. You could recite them, I'm sure. If you can't yet, study them and make sure that you have them as reference points. A disciple of Buddha does not slander. A disciple of Buddha does not harbor ill will. We always have these as a place to come back to. And this tells us that we actually always have, always, in big bold letters, capital, underline, we always have a choice of how to act. So, in a reactive state, I'm likely to kind of substitute one kind of privilege for a different kind of privilege. Say, imagine that I know something that somebody else doesn't know. That's just exchanging arrogance for arrogance. So how about if we make the effort to change the dynamic altogether? So this is what I would call intention. And not simple intention, but an intention with awareness of the impact of that intention. An ongoing examination of how exactly did that behavior turn out? And was the result consistent with the vow or not? If it was not, what do I need to do to adjust? This is an example of aligning ourselves with the effort of actually changing the dynamic rather than changing a simple set of conditions. So at the very least, we have zazen. This is training. Our zazen sitting in non-judgmental present moment awareness. Zazen is exactly the training for this. And as Vicki Austin said a couple of weeks ago, we have a way of settling in zazen, that is, as she described it, with the vagus nerve, allowing the thinking mind and the feeling mind to cooperate and collaborate rather than operate independently of each other. So when we can return to this settled place, in my experience, it's easier, much easier, to step out of reactive and habitual behavior and into choosing. And that is exactly what I would say is the pure and simple color of true practice, of the true mind of faith, of the true body of faith. And this is related to the empathetic joy that simply arises when we're stable. This pure and simple color of true practice is the willingness to return, to stability, to return to vow, to return to intention with an awareness of impact. Offering a Dharma talk is always a challenge to me because the second I open my mouth, I'm already wrong. As soon as I try to put words on something, it's already off the mark. So I just did that, and I'm going to correct it right now. It's not the willingness to return to stability or to vow. It is the returning, the actual activity of returning. So we have a teaching that many of us studied together not that long ago, last fall, I think, that it's called the 12-fold chain of interdependent co-origination. So I won't bore you with naming each link because that gets complex and that's actually worth a couple months of study right there. But I'll make a leap. And I'll describe it this way. Suffering, or we could say hindrance, or we could say distaste, or we could say dissatisfaction. It doesn't matter what of those words you use. It's in varying degrees. Dissatisfaction arises based on the condition of ignorance. So I have leapt over about 8 of the links. Suffering arises based on the condition of ignorance. This is original Buddha teaching. So it's the converse is also true, and it's important to recognize that the Buddha also taught this. When ignorance dissipates, suffering also dissipates. So we have to make the effort to allow ourselves to see clearly. Zazen is the training to do this. The returning to vow strengthens our capacity to do this. So I'm going to offer you a very, very simple practice. When you are stuck in suffering or dissatisfaction or a hindrance of any kind, an obstacle, when you are stuck, literally raise your eyes to the horizon. Change what you see. Broaden your view. And, you know, as Vicky talked about it, this practice is a very somatic experience. Body, mind, heart working together. So when we do something as simple as become overly focused with a hindrance, changing what the eyes are doing, and the hindrance itself will have less of a grip on you. Try it. See if it works for you. To me, the somatic nature of this practice is evident. In a meeting, a frustrating meeting. Change your perspective. Who are you looking at? What are you seeing? Literally, move the eyes. It's a very simple practice. I'd like to hear from you if you try it, how it goes. This returning is what we've talked about in Foundations of Practice as a pivotal moment. And it is, in fact, reality, better said, it's actually attending to reality expressing itself, or reality, even better, revealing itself. So this one, as part of the conditions, attending to the conditions. We don't often think of ourselves as part of the conditions. We think, everything inside this skin bag is me, and everything outside this skin bag is other. We think the conditions are outside other, something else. So this somatic experience of changing where the gaze falls is this person, me, as part of the conditions. This set of conditions co-creating or mutually influencing. So if I want to change the set of conditions, including someone for whom I have distaste, I start with the conditions of this one. It seems so simple, and it's not a simple thing. We know that the habitual would like to pull us back again and again into dualistic thought and behavior. On the relatively near horizon, we have practice period coming up early October, about a month from now. I want to say a little something about practice period. Shamelessly advertising practice period coming up. I'm leading it. The word for practice period we use in Sino-Japanese is ango. And when the nuns and monks were practicing with the Buddha during the rainy season, they sheltered together, for a couple of months. And this became known as what we now call ango, translated as peaceful dwelling. I have to say that that's a little ironic because we know, even in the Buddha's time and with that group of people who were no doubt devoted to each other and to the Buddha, it's also true in contemporary Sangha. When we gather together, it's not necessarily a peaceful dwelling together. All of our stuff comes up, we argue with each other and get positional about stuff. It's not exactly peaceful. But, there are 200 and something like 27 different guidelines for monastic practice. And each and every one of those regulations or guidelines came because the Buddha was trying to solve a non-peaceful dwelling experience. When and how to bathe, when and how to sleep, how to make sounds, how to eat, how to make the zendo sounds and so on, how to put on one's robes. So all of the rules came from a non-peaceful dwelling place. It's like, well, I guess we better solve that. Otherwise, we won't be able to continue to live in harmony. So the Buddha even continually asked himself, what is the need for this community? And what is this community ready for? Gauged his teaching based on what the students themselves were asking for. This is the Buddha enacting, not me teaching you, but let's co-create this reality. We're mutually influencing. There's a brief teaching from a nun at that time whose name was Vijaya. And she said it this way. It's actually very, very encouraging. If you find yourself partly in and partly out, if you find yourself drawn to this path and also drawing away, I can assure you, you're in good company. Just keep going. Sometimes the most direct path isn't a straight one. She meant this to be encouragement during the time of Ango. So I also now encourage you in the potential for you to participate in upcoming practice period. Sometimes the most direct path isn't a straight line. The true mind of faith, the true body of faith, is actively involved in examining the internal and so-called external conditions. And then we make the effort to respond appropriately. This is what we call arousing the vow and negotiating the way. It's pretty clear to me that the climate crisis is actually a spiritual crisis. The way we have objectified the earth and mistreated the resources. It's also pretty clear to me that social justice issues are at their roots spiritual issues. Maybe some of you would like to take this up as part of your practice period focus. That would be great. And we can end up mutually influencing, teaching each other. So I say that in order to emphasize again and again, practice is not passive. Any way that I have misled you by speaking is partly my own fault, my own awkwardness with words. But it's also, what are you bringing to engage with this material? This is not a passive practice. It requires of us that we have some exchange in some way. In the same way that participating in contemporary society requires that we participate. When even for a moment you express the Buddha's seal in the three actions by sitting upright in samadhi, the whole phenomenal world becomes the Buddha's seal and the entire sky turns into enlightenment. The rest of this passage is really quite beautiful. I encourage you to read it, study it. Samadhi Fulfilling Itself is the title. Jijuyu's on my. So, even when we have moments of wishing harm to another, the pivotal moment lives right there. It's not limited to, as we have spoken many times, it's not limited to sitting or standing or walking or lying down. It is any moment that we bring our attention to allows us to choose and generate an appropriate response. Maybe we could have some conversation now about times when you have found a way to return to vow, or when you yourself have wished harm to another and you found a way to find your wiser self. Any questions or comments are welcome. I have to say, these moments after speaking are always a little awkward for me. I don't know whether I have stymied the whole thing or whether you yourselves are kind of just letting it cook. I see Margarita, then Sarah. Please, Margarita.
Just a brief response to what you just said. Sometimes I think there is hesitation because one wants to give space to other people to go first.
Yes.
In the group. So it's not that people, that you stopped it. It's that, you know, there is a little bit of whatever the word is, restraint. You're not wanting to jump in and gobble up the space.
Yes.
So at least that's what I experienced. But yeah, I actually had pretty much the same thought that this anonymous person had, referring to this political leader. And I was talking to a friend of mine over the phone who is also a practicing Buddhist. And I said, wouldn't it be much simpler if Mr. T just dropped dead? Then we don't have to worry about what's going to happen with the election. And it's not that I wished him harm. I thought about it after the conversation was over. And in that particular case, my desire was to neutralize all these evil deeds that this person and his associates, including, you know, cheating and harming and stopping people to exercising their right. So it was more a desire to neutralize him. You know, the alternative was that aliens would kidnap him and then return him to Earth, preferably not to the United States, but to a place like Brazil or North Korea where he can visit his friends. I would be satisfied with that option. And it's not that I bear even that personal hostility. It's just that I am very concerned about the harm that he continues to do and the consequences that some other people have already paid for. But I, in a more serious way, I think that sometimes we have to confront feelings in ourselves, very uncomfortable. And I had another example that was closer to home recently and has to do with the fact that I suffer a lot and for a long time at the hand of a person who had some kind of power over me. And it took me a while to free myself from that influence. And basically, really, I had to go away. And then I dealt with the feelings back then. And more recently, when I heard that this person is very, very ill, he's not going to die anytime soon, but, you know, his health has been really compromised. I noticed that there was a lot of conflicting emotion because a part of me thought, well, serves him well. It's his karma. And a part of me was genuinely concerned about him. And so there was this mixture of concern and, if you will, even some remnants of resentment. And it's taken actually a lot of effort to unravel and find my place. And I recently attended a Buddhist retreat with one of my Tibetan teachers. And interestingly enough, this seemed to be the dominant theme, how we connect our cognitive understanding of Dharma with our actual feeling, including the hurt or damage part that needs to heal. And that is not really possible to arrive at a Dharma place without that part being addressed. There is no shortcut. It needs to be looked at. And sometimes that means even holding it for a long time. And not, because it can be very strong, the feelings can be very strong, not to give them the authority that they're speaking the truth. They're speaking our temporary emotional truth or whatever remnants of hurt and wounds is being left in us, but it's not really the final truth. And it takes some time to arrive to a place of equanimity and of finding again our well-being and our joy and not feeling damaged.
Yes.
That can take weeks and sometimes months or years of work, frankly, depending, you know, on the person. So that's pretty much all I want to say.
Thank you, Margarita. There's quite a bit in what you have said. I want to thank you for allowing my own mind to shift about the pause at the end of Dharma Talk. You see it as a courtesy, and that's lovely, actually waiting to speak before one is a lovely deference, and thank you for shifting my mind about that. You know, it's correct to want to interrupt harm when we see harm occurring, and I think it's very, very important that we not project, especially in this case, project onto one person that one person is the cause of harm. In this case, one person exists within a system. There's a system operating here. So we end up having to choose where shall we try to influence the system. So this, what your own recognizing, and I think probably all of us have felt this at some point or another, the conflicting that you're describing between maybe the wish for revenge that arises simultaneous with concern. Uh-huh. And so that's exactly one of those pivotal aspects that we can turn one way or another. I think that's very important where you ended, Margarita, with we have to put the thinking mind, the cognition you called it, and the feeling mind together in order to even be able to identify or be able to articulate what is the need. What is the need that needs to be expressed here? And perhaps it is addressing a wound, and then we can get past that and start to go into deeper truth and deeper truth and find our own stability. But we have to be able to kind of, go spelunking in our own layers as if exploring a cave. Thank you. There was quite a lot in what you said, Margarita. And Sarah, I saw you.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to speak about, for the last month, I was dealing with a lot of suffering where I work because my computer was very old and was not working well. It would take 5 minutes to do something I should be able to do in less than a minute. And they were supposed to replace it, and then that was delayed, and then there was a miscommunication. And so there was very much frustration. And I did have a bad feeling because one person that I work with, I have to give him credit. I mean, he has to kind of do dirty work. Like, he's the person who will call and make a hard phone call. So maybe that was his mindset. But I was feeling sort of upset with everything. And I did have a bad thought about, like, maybe a house burning down or something. But after that happened, I felt really bad. And so I started to really channel, like, positive energy and prayer and just trying to think really good thoughts for anyone whom I felt unhappy towards. And try to just feel compassion and love and kindness for them instead of feeling irritation.
Yes.
And now things have changed, and I'm able to just let go of everything and not have any hard feelings or not feel like they didn't do, you know, they didn't help me or something. But because what helped me too was I wrote an email to Nettie and talked to her about it. And she helped me to remember that, again, what you said about there's all these different conditions that are influencing things. And so it's kind of like we just have to accept that all these conditions have caused this to happen. And it's our choice how we are going to react to it. Are we going to choose to suffer and to complain and feel bad and violent? Or are we going to choose to accept the conditions as they are and to move forward in a compassionate and kind way? And yes. I do want to say that this one koan, the verse of this koan, is a good one for this circumstance. It says, you must wear the iron kang with no hole. This is a curse that passes to descendants, no trivial matter. If you want to support the house or support the gate and sustain the house, you must be willing to climb a mountain of swords with bare feet. And which we talked about this, Nettie and I, about how living out of your vow and out of the Dharma is not easy. It's something that you are actively aware of what's happening and choosing to move in the best way possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, for teaching us. So when stuff goes wrong, even if it's a frustrating thing at work, right? And stuff goes wrong on a global level, whatever, or national level. When stuff goes wrong, we look to blame, and right? And that's similar to what Vicky talked about a couple of weeks ago. That's an example in the animal world of fighting. You know, that's one of the natural responses of the body, to fight. So blame is just a human example of the animal world fighting. So in some ways, I think what you did is a good model, because you attended to that first. You didn't try to, it sounds like, anyway, you didn't try to suppress it. You didn't try to push it out of the way. You tended to that first. Then you could get on with a deeper conversation, right? But as long as we don't attend to that, or, for example, if we don't attend to our non-attending, it continues to have a grip on us, right? So the second we pay it its attention, its due, it has less of a grip, and then we can move. Then we can find the appropriate response, which is what you did. We always, thank you for that, we always have a choice of how to act. Yes, Susan.
When I'm looking at these type of problems, and especially it's so difficult right now, I look at the causes and conditions that make this situation arise. And I always question whether if a particular leader wasn't there, who else would take his place, because something has happened to make this individual arise in the collective. So I start looking at that and start breaking it down, deconstructing it from there. And when I get frustrated or angry, I ask myself why, and it always turns out that it comes from a compassionate place because I care.
Yes.
So to stick with that instead of, you know, wanting to cause harm, because that just continues the trauma. So I look at these things. Is it a cycle that is repeating itself because it hasn't been addressed yet and hasn't been dealt with and healed, for instance, racism? What else is going on a familial level, a societal level, a cultural level, a national level, and even an international level? Because I don't think that what we're experiencing right now is just solely in this nation. It's happening globally. So what does that speak to me about what I need to look at, or what our society and culture, nation and globe or our species need to look at. So that's how I approach things. And it's a lot of work and I'm still working on it. But I feel at least I have a guide post on how to approach it. And it has been very helpful to me. And it's something I'm sure, like everybody here, I struggle with, you know, it's the protectiveness. The mama bear in me comes out. I don't like to see people suffer. I don't like to suffer. And, you know, what is this mirroring back to me? What is this person or this system that enabled him and all the people that populate the system? What is it speaking to me about? And what do I have to learn? So, thank you.
Thank you, Susan. So this examining causes and conditions and taking the time to deconstruct what's actually happening is the crux of the matter. And you identifying, I care, I feel protective, is the nudge to have us kind of tip in the crux, right? So it is a lot of work. This is what Sarah was talking about, climbing a mountain of sorts, right? It's an impossible task, and yet we do, right? So on the very, very, this is overly simplistic. I'm sorry. I apologize in advance. We can say, in what way am I complicit in this? Right? So if I continue to wish harm to another, I'm only embodying the dualistic and separating nature of the conversation, right? So the work is to get under that and under that and under that until we find our ground and the appropriate response that is not going to perpetuate separation.
It is like peeling an onion.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you very much. These are not easy questions. This is not an easy practice. You know, I've heard it said, Zen is not for everyone. And that's kind of a weird phrase. Zen actually is for everyone. We do this for the benefit of all beings. And anyone who wants to have access to this practice can have access to this practice. And I will say that it takes a lot of guts to stay with it at the depth that y'all are talking about. And I know that each and every one spends their life deconstructing and returning to vow. I thank you all for that. This is enormously supportive for you to be visibly present this evening for each other and knowing that each other is navigating their lives in this way. That is, in fact, the pure and simple color of true practice, of the true mind of faith, of the true body of faith. Maybe that'll be a fine place to stop. Thank you very much for engaging this conversation, being present for each other and for the world. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. All Buddha's 10 directions, 3 times. All honored ones, Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Mahaprajna, Paramita. And now the 4 vows, please. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.